Can someone read Proverbs 24, verse 16? Listen, here it comes.
For a righteous man may fall seven times and rise again, but the wicked shall fall by calamity.
Mm-hmm. Yep. A righteous man falls how many times?
Seven.
And for those of us who are a little more familiar, seven in the scriptures is a number associated with what?
Perfection.
Perfection, completion. In other words, a righteous man, when it says a righteous man wanting to walk in a way of obedience and service and commitment and with zeal, you will completely fall. In fact, there's an old saying I shared a long time ago. It's stuck with me. Christianity is we stumble and get up, we stumble and get up, we stumble and get up all the way to heaven. There's a sense in which that's just the way it is. But you know, if you broke that down, we walk, we stumble, we fall, we get up. We walk, we stumble, we fall. Of the lengths of walking, stumbling, falling, and getting up, it's great to master the walk, and you got to master the get up. But if you don't master all four of those stages, if you don't master the getting up, but you're only focusing on the walk, you're going to be weak. In other words, there has to be a sober recognition. And again, this doesn't fly in society, and it certainly doesn't fly too much in the church. There has to be a sober recognition that we fail, that there's failure. I remember years ago, I'd been walking with the Lord for a few years, and I'd learned there's power in calling something by what it is. Like when you call sin, sin, instead of a phobia or a syndrome or a weakness or a disease. It's a sin. And when I come before God, when I come before my Father and confess my sin, when you confess sin, you realize it's been nailed to the cross, it's been forgiven, washed away by the blood of Jesus Christ, and it's gone in the sight of God. That's what happened to sin. He didn't say what he does with my phobias and my foibles or my genetic whatever. That gets real blurry, and so does the forgiveness, so does the freedom. But if you just call it what it is, and I, one of the things I believe in is fail. You know, I failed, and I remember when my mom was, she wasn't real strong yet in the Lord. She became much stronger, but when I would talk to her about life, and I said, yeah, I just really failed. I really failed. And she was, oh, don't say that. And that is, you know, people don't like to hear you say I failed. I really failed. Because it tends to make everyone else. I don't know why. I assume because everyone fails and they know it. They don't want to admit it, maybe. But there's just this great need and freedom and power in looking at our propensity to fail and making sure that we are. Now, we left off in Ezra 4. If you're not there, you can go back there. The Jews have come back to the land after the nation had been judged. They were sent away to Babylon, as we know, for their idolatry and their disobedience concerning the Sabbath. And the nation was destroyed, the temple was destroyed, the city of Jerusalem was destroyed. And now God has sovereignly begun to bring the nation back. And they've shown up to Jerusalem. And Jerusalem is, as you might recall, completely rubble. It's wiped out. It's a great picture of what sin has done to our lives when we come to Christ. We are not what we were supposed to be. We are not what we were intended to be. We have been devastated by sin. And these they're kind of like refugees, but they're coming home. And they get off to a pretty good start. You might recall that the first thing they did was they built something. What did they build? After they got settled, got a tent or two set up. Anyone remember what they built?
The altar.
The altar. They built that altar. And that signifies that initial coming to God, that sacrifice of Christ, and remember, they built the altar because they were fearful of all the people around them. Does anyone remember the link between why building the altar was their response to being fearful? Instead of building the wall or trying to hire soldiers, why was the first step in dealing with fear to build the altar and institute those sacrifices?
Reconnected with God.
We're gonna get right with you, God. We're gonna align ourselves with you. We're going to implore your favor. And that's the best defense we have. So that was that initial stage, just like we need to come to the cross. And they did that every day. And then the next thing that happened is they built, almost right after that, anyone remember?
Temple.
They built the foundation of the temple. And we talked about that foundational work, that learning the word and kind of getting a feel for how we're supposed to live. There's just those foundational basic truths about the Holy Spirit, about confession, about fellowship, about church, about worship, about reading your Bible, overcoming sin, you know, the basic things. Those are basic things, judgment, heaven, hell, all that. In fact, would you say the rapture is a basic doctrine or an advanced doctrine?
The rapture?
Yeah.
Advanced.
Paul was in Thessalonica for three Sabbath days, and he wrote them a letter saying, now I told you about the Antichrist, the man of sin, and our gathering together. And the rapture was just another, just basic foundational doctrine, return of Christ and all that. So there are some basic things that we get down. But then it comes time to actually live those things out, be built up, learn. You know, it's one thing to know that I'm supposed to pray. It's another thing to actually really pray. It's another thing to know that I'm to confess my sin. It's another thing to learn the skill and the art of actually doing that, you know, and staying free from the power of sin. It's one thing to know about fellowship, and it's another thing to know I'm called to serve in the body, each and every one of us, but it's a whole other thing to start doing that and find out what are my gifts and how do I implement those things. It's one thing to recognize basic foundational doctrine. You have an adversary, the devil. It's a whole other thing to learn how to wrestle with him, to learn how to take the weapons of our warfare. So once the foundation is laid, now they're going to actually start building the temple. And that's a great picture of when we actually start moving forward in our walk, and we notice that it's at that point, chapter 4, verse 1, now when the adversaries of Judah and Benjamin heard that the children of the captivity built the temple unto the Lord God of Israel, then they came, and we saw that's when the opposition really begins. There was intense opposition. And we got through a few things. The first thing we noticed was Satan tempted them. Does anyone have it in their notes? The very first temptation was for the people to
compromise.
Exactly. There was a temptation to compromise. They didn't compromise. Then it says, verse 4, then the people of the land weakened the hands of the people in Judah and troubled them in building. And they weakened them. They troubled them. It has to do with fear and terror and trembling. And so it just kind of is unfolding that they're being opposed. They're just being opposed as they're trying to build the temple and get the city going. They've been faced with compromise. They're dealing with discouragement and fear. But what we want to focus on now is this next prong of the attack, when they're going to be hit with tremendous frustration and delay and ultimately defeat. So I'm going to just try and fly through this chapter, because the details, as interesting as they might be, aren't pertinent to the application that we're looking for tonight. So if you want to go back and decipher some of the things I'm going to skip, feel free to do that. But who was into the counselor, someone that was here? It's been 3 weeks. That's been forever.
Yeah.
Who picked up on that the counselors were the lawyers? Who was talking about that when we were here last? Someone really thought that was cool. Is that Diane?
No, I said lawyer.
Yeah. So they can't stop the Jews from building. So it says verse 5, and they hired counselors, the attorneys. Let's go after them legally. Sound like something churches go through today?
Fins to the left, fins to the right.
Isn't that Casey?
Buffett.
Oh. Buffett, it's Jimmy Buffett.
I thought it was a Grateful Dead thing.
No, it's
no.
Buffett.
You sure it's not Casey's? Anyway, verse 5, and they hired counselors against them to frustrate their purpose all the days of Cyrus, king of Persia, even until the reign of Darius, king of Persia. And in the reign of Ahasuerus, in the beginning of his reign, wrote they unto him an accusation against the inhabitants of Judah and Jerusalem. So actually, that's a very complicated two verses there. The short story is they began to really harass them. They just began to harass them legally. And in the days of Artaxerxes, wrote Bishlam and all these leaders that were opposing the Jews in the area. And it says like 4 or 5 times that they wrote the letter. These guys wrote the letter. Yes, they wrote the letter. Yep, they wrote the letter. They wrote the letter indeed. Yep, they wrote the letter. So there's all these verses about who wrote the letter and that they wrote the letter. And then it finally gets to the letter, which is in verse 11. It says, this is a copy of the letter that they sent unto him, even to Artaxerxes the king, thy servants, the men on this side of the river, and at such a time, be it known unto the king that the Jews which came up from you to us have come to Jerusalem, and they're building the rebellious and the bad city, and have set up the walls thereof and joined the foundations. Be it known unto the king that if this city be built and the walls set up again, then they will not pay toll, tribute, and custom, and so you shall in damage the revenue of the kings. Now because we have maintenance from the king's palace, and it was not proper for us to see the king's dishonor, therefore we have sent and certified or testified to the king, that search be made in the book of the records of your fathers, so shall you find in the book of the records, and know that this city is a rebellious city, and hurtful unto kings and provinces, and that they have moved sedition within the same of old time, for which cause was this city destroyed. And we certify to the king that if this city be built again, and the walls thereof set up, by this means ye shall have no portion on this side of the river. So that's the gist of their letter. They write to the king, and they say, look, you feed us, you know, when they talk about the river, they're talking about the Euphrates and all these nations west of the Euphrates, including Jerusalem in that province there, and the kings on the other side of the river. And so on the west side of the river, they have to kind of govern in a way that pleases the king if they want the king's money. So they're approaching the king saying, there's something really bad happening here, and we want to let you know about it so that you don't think we're involved in this because we need your money. These Jews that have come from Cyrus, have come from edict of the king, they're rebuilding Jerusalem. And man, they're building walls, they're building the foundation, and they are going to rebel against you. They are going to rebel against you. We guarantee it, and we can guarantee it because if you look in their past history of Jerusalem, you're going to see that it's been a rebellious city, a troublesome city, a powerful city, and that they would not submit to anyone. And that's true. That was all true. They wouldn't. They were powerful. They had King David. They had Solomon. They had Uzziah. They had great kings. And when Babylon tried to subject them, they refused to do it. So they just send, and they're trying to obviously get the king to undercut them. So then sent the king an answer to all these guys that dwell in Samaria and unto the rest beyond the river. And he said, peace. And at such a time, the letter which you sent unto us has been plainly read before me, and I commanded, and search has been made, and it is found that this city of old time has made insurrection against kings, and that rebellion and sedition have been made therein. There have been mighty kings also over Jerusalem, which have ruled over all countries beyond the river, and toll and tribute and custom was paid unto them. This is all true. Everything he said, he just found it in the records, is the truth about what's going on in Jerusalem. So he says, verse 21, give ye now commandment to cause these men to cease, and that the city be not built, until another commandment shall be given from me. Take heed now that ye fail not to do this. Why should damage grow to the hurt of the kings? So it's, you know, just to pull the curtain back a little bit to show that it's more than just a dry document, as fascinating to me as it is this edict of the king is going to shut down the work of the Jews rebuilding the temple and rebuilding their city and rebuilding their lives. And his edict, the command to stop, is based completely on the past and the truth about the past, which is just a helpful little note, because that is one of Satan's great weapons, isn't it? To point out your what?
Mistakes.
Your past. And to say your past disqualifies you from what you're trying to do. And Satan has stopped many a Christian right in their tracks with this, just simply laying out the truth of the past. So anyway, he hears what their concerns are. He verifies, yeah, man, this has been a really troublesome, powerful city. So go stop it. So take heed now, verse 22, that you fail not to do this. Why should damage grow to the herd of the kings? Now when the copy of King Artaxerxes' letter was read before Rehum and Shimshai the scribe and their companions, they went up in haste to Jerusalem unto the Jews and made them to cease by force. What did they make to cease by force?
The building.
On a practical level, true. On a broader application level, when they were forcing the building and the work on the building to cease, what were they causing to cease?
The motivation, the want to complete.
That's going to come. Whose will and command ultimately was it that the city be and the temple be rebuilt?
God's.
This was God's work. This was God's plan in the lives of these Jews. And they were doing it. And they were doing it faithfully. And it got stopped. It got stopped. They by force, there was nothing these Jews could do. Now that's a rather profound thing to consider. Is wait a minute. God commanded his people, go back, which they did, at great hardship and great cost. And I'll move on the hearts for all the provision and on Cyrus the king and give you an edict. And they went and they did it. And through all this hardship and all this difficulty, they're building and they're being faithful and they're being diligent. And they have enemies and they're continuing on. And the enemies are empowered by force to stop the work. Anyone else you could think of in the Bible that was doing what God wanted them to do? And Satan just stopped them? Well, let's do a little journeying. Because this concept, I think, is crucial. This is important to understanding this issue of defeat. They're defeated here. They've been defeated in their plan. And we're going to see it wasn't a little defeat. It was a big defeat. It was a major setback. So let's go to 1 Thessalonians chapter 2. And we're going to look at a couple of things in the scriptures and string them together. And I think they'll paint an important part. Some of them we won't look at, we'll just talk about. But let's start with this one. Because I think that the greatest, most powerful, spiritual juggernaut the planet's ever known, can't count Christ, he's totally separate, was who? The apostle
Paul.
This guy knew what he was doing. So he's talking in chapter 2 of 1 Thessalonians about when he came and saw them and how he taught them and how they're always opposed. His ministry was being opposed by the Jews. And he talks in verse 15 about the Jews. He said, they both killed the Lord Jesus and their own prophets and have persecuted us. They please not God and are contrary to all men, forbidding us to speak to the Gentiles, that they might be saved, to fill up their sins always, for the wrath of God has come upon them to the uttermost. But we, brethren, being taken from you for a short time in presence, not in heart, endeavoring more abundantly to see your face with great desire, wherefore we would have come unto you, even I, Paul, once and again, but
Satan hindered us.
The man of God, who doesn't lack anything in faith, doesn't lack anything in power, doesn't lack anything in discernment, never says, I wanted to come to you, but it wasn't God's will. He says, I wanted to come to you, but Satan, now, the King James is sweet, right? Satan hindered us. Another way of saying that is, I really wanted to come to you, but Satan,
he won.
He won that one. He won that round. I wanted to get to you, couldn't do it. Go to Luke chapter 22. Jesus is preparing his disciples for, in this last night, his crucifixion. And familiar verse, as Peter's been popping off, as you know, verse 31, Luke 22, 31. And the Lord said, Simon, Simon, behold, Satan has desired to have you, that he may sift you as wheat. But I have prayed for you that your faith fail not. And when you're converted, strengthen your brethren. Satan, did anyone have a translation that's different than Satan has desired you? Anyone got something different?
Satan demanded to have you.
Satan demanded to have you.
Sift you.
Sift you. Anyone else?
Satan has asked for you.
Satan has asked for you. It's a very interesting Greek word. It's like exalzia or something, but the literal definition is to ask or demand that one be given up to one from the power of one to another. It's like having someone in your power. This word that says Satan has desired, asked, demanded, says, I demand, I request that he be given from your power into my power. And the answer was yes.
For a season.
Yes. You, he was given to, as we always know, a limited degree, but he was given to the power of Satan. Now, we don't know for how long. What shortly happened after this?
He denied him three times.
He denied him three times, but I would like to suggest to you that that may or may not have been the... This happened how many days before the resurrection?
Three days.
This is the night of Jesus Christ's crucifixion. Peter denies Christ that night. After Jesus rose from the dead, he first saw who? Who did he first appear to? Anyone remember?
Mary.
But he also made a private personal appearance to Peter. We find out in the book of 1 Corinthians 15, he appeared to Peter, no doubt restored him. That meant Peter spent 3 days after denying Christ until he was restored. I have a very strong confidence that this is what Satan was after, those 3 days. 3 days. What do you think Peter went through for those 3 days?
Torment.
You know some thoughts of suicide had to be going through his head. Had to. He doesn't know Jesus is going to resurrect and he's going to see him again. He doesn't know that. Doesn't know that's coming. We know they didn't believe that. For 3 days. I mean, just, and he's under Satan's power. The point is, there was nothing Peter could do during that time. He was going to be under his power. There was apparently nothing Paul could do to get out from that hindrance. Flip over to Revelation chapter 2. Let's look at least one more. This one is pretty stunning because of the answer to some of the questions that I will ask after we read this. Church of Smyrna, not New Smyrna. Something tells me the church in New Smyrna would not be able to endure this any more than we could. They're a weak church. They're in a satanically controlled city. And they're very poor and they're very persecuted and they need help. And here is Jesus' response to this persecuted, poverty-stricken church. Verse 10. He says, fear none of those things which you shall suffer. Behold, the devil shall cast some of you into prison that you may be tested, and you shall have tribulation 10 days. Be thou faithful, and you'll be released. No. Be thou faithful unto death, and I'll give you a crown of life. Now, aside from trying to find the comfort, because you get the crown of life anyways, what could these Christians do by faith and prayer and fasting and reading to get out of this situation?
Nothing.
Nothing.
Die.
Nothing. There was nothing they could do because this has been granted, apparently, to Satan. Now, he was allowed to, we see it even in the Old Testament. What was Satan allowed to do to Job?
Everything but kill him.
First of all, he took away all his wealth.
His family.
Then he took, well, not his entire family. Satan was clever. He left him his wife.
Nagging wife.
He left him his wife to make sure and encourage him to curse God and die. Because he needed a mouthpiece and his wife qualified. So, but nothing Job could do about that. You are going to, that would look pretty defeated, right? That was a time of, you lost that one. And then, obviously, here in New Smyrna, in Smyrna, they're under Satan's power. Peter comes under Satan's power. Paul suffers for a time under Satan's power. Let's go back to Ezra chapter 4. Kind of resume this really uplifting study. The moral of the story in our lives, the moral here that we have to start with, I mean, sometimes he wins. Satan. Sometimes he wins. Sometimes he's going to win in the battles. Now, look at verse 24. Then ceased the work of the house of God, which is at Jerusalem. Is it not, in this analogy, it's a picture of the Christian life being built up, the Christian church being built up. But let's keep it to an individual, are any of us willing to deny that there are periods of time when you would say, the work ceased, the work slowed down, the work was really retarded, it was so slowed down at that point, I just stopped praying. Mm-hmm. For some of us, I stopped even going to church, I stopped reading my Bible, I stopped thinking even about the things of God, the work ceased. He wins sometimes. And the problem is if we don't understand this, see, here's the real tragedy. It says, verse 24, then ceased the work of the house of God which is in Jerusalem. There's a well-put period there, because it goes on to say, the next thought, so it ceased unto the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. You don't catch that in the context immediately, 15 years. It's a 15-year hiatus. That's the issue. Because a righteous man stumbles or falls seven times, but then what? He gets up. These guys didn't get up. They did not get up. And you find that out. And I'm not sure when we'll get to it, but when you get to the very first verse, these two guys kick in, then the prophets, Haggai the prophet and Zechariah. When you go to the book of Haggai, when you go to Zechariah, you find out what's going on with these people. And they didn't get up. They got knocked down. That happens. You lose a round. But a righteous man gets up. But sometimes if we're not prepared, if the coach who says we're going to win, we're never going to get behind. If the Christian expects I should be victorious all the time, I should not have done that. Or I shouldn't feel like that. Or why have I experienced it? Why am I thinking, the defeat? We get defeated. We really get defeated. And sometimes we've been doing our best. These guys were doing their best. They were doing the right thing. They were doing their best. They by force, it stopped. But the challenge, and that's the key to this part of the book and why it's so crucial to me, is this whole thing, what's hinging here is, yeah, you lost that round, but you didn't have to lose the next five. You didn't have to go down in the fight, the battle. And so there's a lot here, I believe, to look at and stop and consider, because we all get knocked on the canvas. We all take a shot to the jaw by Satan. And it doesn't matter how godly Paul was righteous, Peter was walking with the Lord. But there are times when he just wins. Now, when I say, and what you see in here, there are times when Satan wins, it doesn't mean he can make us sin. He can't make us sin. He can tempt us. He cannot make anyone sin. That is something God never gives us over to, always gives us the power. And we see the promises in the New Testament. God is faithful and not lying. We tend to bond, but we're able. But with the temptation, we'll provide a means of escape that you might be able to bear up under it, withstand it. He will never, abandon us to Satan. However, that doesn't mean that there aren't seasons and haven't been seasons and won't be seasons where Satan is given access or given power to some degree over our lives. He can close doors. He can cause things to fail.
But God's allowing him to.
God allows him to.
Okay. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have free reign.
He doesn't have free reign. But let's put, when God, first of all, let's take the people in Smyrna. Satan was going to be allowed to do what to them?
Kill them.
Kill them. And there are times, I don't think that happens very often when God lets Satan kill someone, but I know from personal experience, and you probably do, there are times God allows Satan to oppress us and torment us. And he has access to, I don't know how that works precisely, but maybe he just, there's a period of time where he can haunt you. Isn't it amazing how sometimes there'll just be a season where past sins are almost like roaring. They're just screaming. There are times he thwarted Paul. Anyone here ever endeavored to do a ministry and seemed like God was really blessing it and it got shut down? Or it failed? I mean, we get, you know, we're determined. I'm going to pray. I'm going to rejoice. I'm going to sing. I'm going to be filled with faith. And there's no reason not to be happy all the time. And God says, you know, I'm going to just give Satan access to you for a season. And it's not that he can take all of our joy, but he can make us very oppressed. Just look at the things we've read that he can do. It says, resist the devil and he will. But you know that word resist is in the aorist tense, which means it's an ongoing thing. It doesn't mean, stop that, Satan! And he's gone. It's an ongoing thing, because let's put it, if who of the people we looked at here would be a good, if Job had said, I rebuke you, Satan, get away from my body and my boils and my pus and my misery and my night, get away from me. I rebuke these nightmares in Jesus' name. Would that have worked? I don't think so, because God said, you can do anything you want, just don't, you can't kill him. So I think it's necessary to recognize that even though it's not the norm in the Christian life, the scriptures lay out, and here, there are seasons where they had no power over this. You lost that one. Okay. The danger is in how we respond to that. The danger is if we don't recognize that there are going to be seasons where, man, I just didn't win that one. All kinds of things go wrong. All kinds of things can go wrong. First and foremost is I was doing my best and I was serving the Lord and I was praying and reading and next thing you knew, I was just miserable and angry and depressed and I didn't want to go to church and I started finding myself thinking about all the past things that, you know, I wanted to drink and I fell into the, and if we are ignorant of this, one of the first thoughts is, what's wrong with me? And Satan just jumps on that and says, oh, what's wrong with you is you're probably not even saved. If you are saved, you're certainly not given over to Christ. Your heart's obviously wrong. Yeah, you're right. And the next thing you know, I can't do this. And the Christian highway to heaven is strewn with Christians that were doing really well, but reached the point of saying, I just can't do this. I'm not one of those spiritual people. I'm not one of those zealous people. I'm not one of those called people. I'm just gonna limp into heaven. Or maybe if we don't think something's wrong with me, you know, we were giving our time, we were giving our prayers, we were giving our money, we were doing something for God, and it just blew up. I was doing everything right. I was praying like Job was. I was obedient like Job was. I was doing everything right, and this thing just blew up. Well, how can I trust God after that? How many people who are genuinely saved but have lost their trust in God? Because they perhaps didn't recognize, yeah, that did blow up. Doesn't mean God did it, and it doesn't mean God's done. But see, the danger is being discouraged and quitting. Quitting. That's what these people, as we're going to see, these people quit. They quit. They were building. They were defeated in this battle here. And rather than recognizing, okay, we've had a setback, but let's go. They quit. And quitting, I think, can take many different forms and shapes and many degrees, right? You can quit and say, I'm done with God, I'm done with church, I'm done with it all. That's bad, obviously. But there's other kinds of quitting, aren't there? I'm not gonna pray. Really. I'm not gonna look to serve, really. I'm not gonna be zealous like I was. I'm just not gonna. We have to be aware that oh man, I don't want to be defeated because maybe for a season in my life, either I blew it or there was a season where Satan he won that one. Because somehow I had it in my mind from that bad teaching, from that bad coach and those bad expectations, this kind of bad thing, it's not gonna happen to me. I'm not. And then it does. It's like, oh, I'm disqualified. Why does God, do you think? What are some of the reasons why God, I mean, God allowed this. God actually is the one that when Job was doing so well, just like you perhaps were doing really well, God's the one that said to Satan, have you noticed, Job? God initiated it. God prompted that. God could have kept Peter from coming under Satan's power at any time, but he chose to let him. He could have said to those people in Smyrna, you just hang tough for 10 days and I'll deliver you and you're going to stomp Satan. Why does God allow Satan to have victory over us, and why does he at times, remember, as long as you win the last game of the year, you won. So you can have a lot of defeats along the way. God can allow a lot of defeats along the way as long as we're standing at the end. We won the big thing, the big prize. Why does God allow defeat along the way? What are some of the things that are accomplished by letting my spiritual butt get kicked like that? Why did you let me get knocked?
You weren't built on stone.
That's true, like Peter. What, you know, there are many sins and God doesn't like any of them. What is the number one? Pride. What's the relationship between God letting us be defeated? We don't see pride in ourselves most of the time. Rarely do I walk around and go, hey, I gotta confess to you guys, I'm just really filled with pride right now. I just can't. I don't know, I know it's not appropriate, but I'm just really proud right now. We don't do that, but we don't usually don't see pride. Other people see it in us, but we usually don't see it in ourselves, but clearly God sees it. And doesn't he know how to essentially, because that's what he did with Peter to a certain degree. Peter had this pride, I will
die for you.
I'll die for you, I'll never deny you. Because he was proud in his own courage and strength. And, you know, it's not that Satan and God are buddy-buddy, but there's a sense in which God just trained Satan's laser on those issues. That refining process, you know, those things are exposed and dealt with. I think it's safe to say there's often a training process in this, because I'm sincere and I'm genuine, but I'm perhaps walking, because I haven't learned yet, I'm walking in my own strength. I haven't yet learned how to really depend on the Lord, because I've always been able to get it done. I mean, that's the problem with smart people. They always figure it out. And they think they can figure everything out in their life. And God really has to slam those people to make them go, I'm not one of those smart people, but I will tell you this. It wasn't until, I think it's been 4, maybe 5 years ago now, for the first time in my life 5 years ago, God pinned me down where I could not fix a problem I was in. There was always a way. There was always a way. Always a way to fix it. It was shocking to go. And terrifying. Mm-hmm. I can't fix this. But he often leads us, I believe, one of the reasons he leads us into those, gives us that taste of defeat, lets the enemy take us down, is he's training us, because as long as we are relying in our own strength, we're really limited in what we can do. In fact, turn to Jeremiah chapter 12. Did I say Jeremiah 12?
Yes, yes, you did.
Oh, it's a good one. So Jeremiah is going to fail. He's going to fail here. He's been overwhelmed, and he fails a few times. We looked at one a while back where he actually quits. He says, I quit, God. I'm done. I quit. I resign from prophet of Judah. Here's my resignation. But here's another time where he gives up on God in a very real way. He says in verse 1, righteous art thou, O Lord, when I plead with you. God, I know you're right, yet let me talk with you of your judgments. You really blew this one, God. I mean, I really respect you because you are God, but you're wrong here. He says, why does the way of the wicked prosper? Why are they always happy that are dealing treacherously? You planted them. They take root. They grow. They bring forth fruit. You're near in their mouth, but far from their range. You bless these hypocrites. But you, Lord, you know me. You've seen me. And you've tried my heart. And you've made my life miserable, God, in your tests. Pull them out like sheep for the slaughter and prepare them for the day of slaughter. How long shall the land mourn and the herbs of every field wither for the wickedness of them that dwell there? God, why are you letting this get so bad? You're blowing this. The beasts are consumed and the birds because they said, he shall not see our last end. What's happening is his faith is really breaking down. He's just really like, I'm done. So God, a respectful, I don't. Watch this, verse 5. Jeremiah, if you've run with the footmen and they've wearied you, then how are you going to contend with the horses? And if in the land of peace, wherein you trust us, you're at peace, they've wearied you, then how will you do in the swelling of the Jordan? He's saying to Jeremiah, you can probably pick it up from this, I see you're having a hard time, Jeremiah. It's going to get worse. I know you're upset with me because this is really hard, but Jeremiah, I'm training you with the footmen because I know the horses are right around the corner. And I'm training you in this time of peace because a storm's coming that's going to flood this place. For even your brethren and the house of your father, even they have dealt treacherously with you. Yea, they've called a multitude after you. Believe them not, though they speak fair words. He said, God's given, here's an example, Jeremiah. You don't know this. You don't see it coming. Your family is going to turn on you and try and kill you. I'm preparing you for that. I'm training you for that. I am allowing you to break down and go past what you can handle now because you're not relying on me. You're relying on your own abilities. And so, Jeremiah, I'm training you. I'm preparing you. And he does it. You see in the scriptures that God does allow oftentimes failure and delay and difficulty as he's preparing someone for something that is going to be much harder. And Jairus is one of those guys. Jairus was frantically trying to get Jesus to come with them. Hurry, my daughter's dying. How frantic can you get? My daughter's dying and it's a race against death. And he's pulling Jesus along and the crowds, and Jairus loses the battle. Because Jesus kind of shakes loose from Jairus because he's got to deal with this woman. She's got an issue of blood, and Jesus said, hey, who touched me? And Peter's like, who didn't touch you? Everyone touched you. What are you talking about? And Jesus' like, no, someone touched. And Jairus is going, no. And that woman comes forward, and I was, diseased for 12 years and lost all my family, and I spent all my money, and nothing helped. And Jesus called her daughter and said, your faith has healed you, go in peace. She went, like, wow. And just then, Jairus' friend comes up and says, don't even bother him anymore, your daughter's dead. And Jesus says to Jairus, just what he said to the woman, it's your faith, only believe, she's going to be made whole. The same word he used when he said to the woman, daughter, your faith has made you whole. 12-year-old daughter, 12-year-old disease, same language, same everything. And no doubt that breakdown in Jairus is trying to get Jesus as fast as he could, that 10-minute breakdown, 15-minute, whatever it was, the Lord knew what he was doing. It's like, no, Jairus, you need to, I'm gonna purposely fail you here. I'm not going to go along with your plan. It's going to fall apart. I'm stopping. Because I know that you're not going to get home before you get the news that your daughter's dead. And you're not ready. You are not ready to hear that. So God always has, I believe, this purpose in letting things happen, our defeat, and certainly one of them is just, if you want to put it in one giant. And when I say the truth, there's another reason I think that God allows us to be defeated. Remember, Jesus told Mary through Simeon, when they came to dedicate Jesus, he told her, and a sword's going to pierce through your own soul because the thoughts of many are going to be revealed about you when they speak against this child. When your son grows up, the truth about where people are really at is going to come out as you watch him die, as that defeat happens, as it looks like your son is going to be made a mockery of. You're going to hear horrible things. And one of the reasons I think God does allow us to go through some really tough times that we can't control is you do find out who your friends are. You do find out a lot about people when you're down that you might not find out otherwise. Any amens on that? Well, I want to just wrap this up pretty quickly by just kind of giving a preview of where it's going. So again, this key verse, the end of the chapter, so then ceased the work of the house of God which is at Jerusalem. There was nothing they could do about that. It was going to stop. There was power, there was authority, there was a decree from the king. So it ceased unto the second year of the reign of Darius, king of Persia. Again, well, 15-year delay. And we're going to see the danger. Okay, you had a setback, you had a defeat, but you didn't handle it right. And watch the result of them not handling it right. Flip over to Haggai, because we'll find out what went on in the minds of these people when they didn't respond properly, when they didn't get up. Haggai. You know, there's two prophets that show up that begin to shake the people into doing the work that God's called them to do, Haggai and Zechariah. If you read them, it's pretty cool. It's a good cop, bad cop thing. Zechariah is the good cop. Haggai is the bad cop. Haggai comes along and, you know, kind of roughs them up a bit. And then Zechariah comes along and says, it's okay. You know, everything's going to be fine. But first the bad cop has to show up. So Haggai now shows up 15 years later from when the decree to force this building to stop occurred. And we find out what's been going on, among other things. So it was in the second year of Darius, just like it said. Remember it said there, it went on, the building ceased until the second year of Darius the king. That's what we read, the last verse. It says, in the second year of Darius the king, in the sixth month, in the first day of the month, came the word of the Lord by Haggai the prophet unto Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, the governor of Judah, and to Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest and the governor. Thus speaketh the Lord of hosts, saying, this people say, watch this, the time is not come, the time that the Lord's house should be built. Well, there's some truth to that. Because they were building the house, and something totally beyond their control that they could not stop happened to them, right? It wasn't like they just got discouraged and they were yelled at and you guys are stupid, you know? These guys showed up with swords and spears and an army and said, stop. And they forced it to stop, and they had to stop.
Cease and desist.
Yeah, it was a legal cease and desist order. They had to stop. It was not time at that point to build God's house. But now it's 15 years later, and they're still saying it. Thus speaks the Lord of hosts, saying, this people say the time has not come, the time that the Lord's house should be built. Yeah, it's just not God's will that we do this. Did you see the setback? It's not God's will that I serve. Did you see what happened to me when I got involved at church? Did you see what happened when I started doing that? Did you see what, when I was really zealous and I was really giving it my best? Did you see what happened to me? Yeah, it's not God's will that I be zealous, you know, or whatever. So, this people say the time has not come, the time that the Lord's house should be built. Then came the word of the Lord by bad cop Haggai, the prophet, saying, well, is it time for you, O ye, to dwell in your sealed houses and this house lie waste? It seems like you've settled into this thing, it's not time to build God's house, but it's time to build my house. It's not time to put forth energy and time and resources into God's house. It's time to do that for my house. And they're obviously going to be rebuked. Now, therefore, thus says the Lord of hosts, consider your ways. I mean, is that really rational thinking? Is that right thinking? Is that the right response to this defeat that you experienced? That I'm just not called to do this. I'm not called to do this. You have sown much and you bring little. You eat, but you have not enough. You drink, but you are not filled with drink. You clothe yourself, but there's none warm. And he that earns wages to be put into a bag with holes. Thus says the Lord of hosts, consider your ways. Go up to the mountain, bring wood, and build the house, and I will take pleasure in it, and I will be glorified, says the Lord. You looked for much, and it came to little, and when you brought it home, I did blow upon it. So what you can see is they were defeated in their attempt to build God's house. They went through a major setback. And then they just settled into that condition. They stayed there. They got stuck there. They rationalized because of their defeat why it was right to live in a continually defeated condition, because the reality is that defeated spiritual condition enabled them to pursue other things that they became really fond of. I can't do that. I can't do that for God. I can't do that for God. Might as well just work on my stuff, gain my stuff, build my stuff. And God wasn't against them working on their house. He wasn't against them having a good life. What he was against was, no, you suffered a defeat way back then. You should be back up on your feet and getting your life and the ministry and your service back in order. That needs to be put in order. My house first. My house first. Okay, there was a setback where Satan got the best of you. Satan actually won that one. You blew it. He defeated you. He diverted you. Get up. Get up now. And so that's one of the things that you see about if defeat isn't handled properly, it can be rationalized away. That's what they rationalized it. It's not time to build God's house. He must want me to build my house. He didn't bless me when I did that, so he must want me to not try and do that. And rather than get up, God must want me to lay on the canvas spiritually. That's the first thing we see them doing. And then the second thing that we see going on when he was saying you're planting much, you don't get much, you're hoping for all these things, is they had become calloused to God's correction. God was correcting them all. You know, I don't know how long this was supposed to last, this cease and desist order, whether it was 6 months or 1 year, but as they began to accept the defeat and rationalize the defeat and essentially take a much lower level of commitment to God's work in God's house, God began to correct them. God began to chasten them. God began to spank them a bit, and they grew callous to it. They just accepted that's just the way life is. And so he raises up Haggai to point out to them, this is wrong. Your life's out of order. Your nation's out of order. You've let that setback cripple you. And I'm calling you to get up and get going again. And does that not just ring true to you? That just is an ongoing thing that needs to go on in my life. That's ongoing. Because a righteous man falls. Not once 15 years ago. I fell 15 years ago, and I fell 14 years ago, and I fell 10 years ago, and I fell earlier today. I just fall all the time. And I need to not allow the enemy to turn that temporary setback into a permanent crippling thing. You know, it's just like, got to get back on the horse and ride. And lastly, let's go to Zechariah real quick, just to see the good cop before we're done. And that's why these books are really fun to study together, Ezra and Nehemiah and Haggai and Zechariah and Malachi, because all five of those books are woven together into one time. Zechariah chapter 4 is one of my all-time favorite chapters, and it's a vision that Zechariah had. You know, stop, it's too late. Stop. It's late. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to stop. I'm going to learn. Been doing this 30 years. I'm learning to stop.
That's when it's like time to stop.
Well, read Zechariah 4. You'll find some really neat stuff in there.